Okay, let's go ahead and get started. I know some people are still walking in, but it is 11:30. Thank you all for coming. My name is Scott Schnall. I'm a principal technical writer on the Exchange team at Microsoft. And among other things, I'm responsible for the product documentation, the stuff you read in TechNet, for example, around high availability, site resilience, disaster recovery, also some of the virtualization and deployment work as well. So I'm super excited to be here. This is my third year in a row speaking at TechEd Australia. Super excited to be here again talking about Exchange 2010 high availability. This session is discussing high availability concepts, and we have several that we're going to be talking about over the next 75 minutes. We are also recording these sessions, so if you have a cell phone, or some device, or if you like Tad in the video, maybe you still have a pager. If you could turn that to silent or vibrate, that would be great. So the concepts we're going to discuss today, first I have a little bit of terminology I just want to go over, just really three terms I want to make sure that you understand what Exchange's definition of those terms are. Then we're going to talk about the concept of quorum. It's an extremely important concept that underlies the database availability platform that we have inside of Exchange 2010. Then we're going to talk about the concept of witness and what a witness server and an alternate witness server is. We're also going to talk briefly about Active Manager. We're not going to go too deep in this session. On Friday, at the same time in meeting room 8, I've got a deep dive on the high availability platform, and we're going to go very, very deep into the inner workings of Active Manager in that session. We're also going to talk about a property of database copies called activation preference and how it comes into play inside the platform. We'll talk a little bit about circular logging and what it means in a continuous replication environment because there are some changes there. We'll also talk about some other properties, one called replay lag and truncation lag. And then the last thing we'll end up with is just a brief overcap of what the two modes of continuous replication that we have in Exchange 2010 and how they both work. So let's start briefly with some terminology. There's just three terms I really want to make sure that you understand because while you may have heard these terms, you may have even heard them from other people at Microsoft in different product groups. We actually have very specific definitions of these terms that we use for the Exchange product itself. So the terms, for example, high availability. From an Exchange perspective, high availability has to have three criteria. If the solution doesn't have service availability, data availability, and automatic corrective action for most failures, not all, but most, then we don't consider it a highly available solution. So, for example, if you look historically in the Exchange Server product line, you can see that we really didn't have a solution that met all of these criteria until we introduced cluster continuous replication in Exchange 2007. All previous versions of Exchange had what we called a legacy shared storage cluster, or what became the single copy cluster in 2007. And that's basically a model that provided service availability and recovery for many failures, but there was no built-in replication in that solution for the data, so it didn't have data availability. It wasn't until CCR with continuous replication that we introduced that and finally had a solution that met all three criteria. Now, a similar solution, and in fact, it's even more related in Exchange 2010 than ever before because now we have a single platform for both HA and site resilience. But this concept of site resilience. Site resilience is nothing more than a configuration you deploy in order to achieve redundancy in the event you lose a data center. So you've got a primary data center and a second data center, sometimes refer to that as an alternate data center. And when the level of service that your primary data center is no longer able to provide at that required level, that's when you would do a data center switchover and activate what some of you might call your DR site or a standby site. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. The last term is actually it's a couple terms put down and compressed into a single term. That term is star overs. So you'll see that asterisk with the word overs next to it. That's how we pronounce it, star overs. That's our shorthand notation for switchovers and failovers. Hopefully, those terms are not new to you. Switchover is when an administrator manually takes corrective action, and the failover is when the system does it for you. And keep that thought in your mind because literally when you think about the Exchange platform and what the database availability group and mailbox database copies can provide you really only get two forms of corrective action with this product. One that's automatic, the system does it for you. it's a failover, one that is manual. You have to, as the administrator, have to intervene and take corrective action. That's a switchover. Okay. Now, switchovers and failovers can happen at different levels. So for instance, you can have a database switchover. It's a single database moving between members of a DAG, maybe in the same site, maybe in a different site. You can also have a server switchover and failover. So you can have a server star over. For instance, we have a script that we included in Service Pack 1 called Start DAG Server Maintenance. One of the things that script does in preparing to take a DAG member and put it into maintenance mode is it does a server switchover. It takes all of the active copies of that databases on that server and moves them to one or more other DAG members. Now, at the data center level, though, we don't have star overs. There's no concept known as a data center failover. In other words, if you lose service in your primary data center, the system doesn't automatically recover for you. It's always that manual site resilience procedure. Okay, we call that a data center switchover. Okay, so there's no such thing as a data center failure. It's a failover. It's always going to be a manual process. Now, you can automate it. Most of it is just running some PowerShell commands, maybe one or two cluster commands, depending on your configuration. So all of that can be automated, but it's still going to require a human to make the decision to do that in the first place. Okay, let's talk about the first concept. And this concept, as I mentioned, underpins everything. It's the concept of quorum. And quorum's not a new concept. It's been around certainly throughout the Windows failover cluster product lifecycle, and even before then in groups of other systems that were clustered together to sort of act as one. Quorum is basically this consensus-based voting mechanism that ensures that really at any given time, only one subset of the members of the cluster are up and functioning. And now subset can be a misleading term. Subset could mean a majority of the members, but it could also mean all of the members as well. All is a subset of all as well. So it could be one or all members are up, as long as you have a specific subset that are functioning and responsible for this shared view of what's going on inside the cluster. Now, what's going on inside an Exchange 2010 cluster is much less interesting than what went on in previous versions. In previous versions, you had a construct known as a clustered mailbox server. It had all these resources in it, and those resources were managed by the cluster. We don't use a cluster resource anymore. Instead, we have a new component that handles all of that monitoring and corrective action for us. It's called Active Manager, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But we still have this concept of quorum that we use from the cluster to represent that. So in the case of an Exchange 2010 DAG, for instance, really the cluster is just representing a shared view of the clustered members and a few resources like IP addresses and a network name. And if you've got an even number of members in your DAG, a witness resource as well, which we'll talk about. Now, quorum can be confusing to some people because we actually use it to represent two things. It can be that consensus model that I just described, but it can also refer to the actual cluster database itself, or what we sometimes refer to as the quorum data. This is data that's shared between all of the members of the cluster, and it's in that database where changes that occur in the cluster are written to and then replicated to all the other members as well. So that's why the concept of quorum can be confusing sometimes, because there's actually also this concrete form of quorum known as the quorum data, the quorum database. Now, quorum is important. It's not just necessary for the cluster to function, but it's necessary for your DAG to function as well. If you don't have quorum in a DAG, the DAG will not be able to mount databases, clients will not be able to connect, and there will be no activity whatsoever in that DAG unless and until quorum is restored. So it's extremely important that whatever solution you're designing is designed to handle failure scenarios such that when the failures you're protecting against occur, the solution still has enough members in there to maintain quorum and keep the rest of the solution up and functioning. Now, there's four quorum models that Windows Failover Clustering has, but Exchange will only use two of them. It'll either use the node majority quorum model for DAGs that have an odd number of members, or it will use a node and file share majority for DAGs that have an even number of members. And I'll illustrate what that means in a minute. But those are the only two types of quorum models that we'll use. And as you add mailbox servers to a DAG or remove mailbox servers from the DAG, Exchange itself will dynamically change the cluster quorum model for you, and you don't really have to worry about changing back and forth. Now, the concept of quorum is not just important for DAG functions, but it's also going to speak directly to the overall resilience of the solution. So you can see from the numbers here, simply put, the larger the DAG that you have, the greater the resiliency. So for instance, if you look at a 6-member DAG, that's an even member DAG, so it's going to have this extra witness to provide a total of 7 votes. The majority of 7 is 4, so you can lose 3 votes and still maintain majority and have the solution up and running. But by contrast, if you look at a 15-member DAG, that's already got an odd number. We don't need a witness there, so we've got 15 votes. You can lose up to 7 votes in that DAG and still have the solution up and running. So larger DAGs inherently provide greater resilience. And of course, the largest you can go is 16 members. If you need more than 16 members, you're talking about multiple DAGs at that point. So here's a very basic illustration of the two differences between the quorum models. Up at the top, we have a DAG with an odd number of members, so it uses the node majority quorum model. Down at the bottom, we have a DAG, which is this blue bounded area, so up the top and down at the bottom. It uses the node and file share majority. It has an even number, so it needs this extra server that's not a member of the DAG to act as a witness. In other words, to provide a tie-breaking vote inside the cluster. So one of the differences here is you've got this quorum database. Every member of the DAG, every member of the cluster has a copy of that. The witness server does not. Instead, also, every member of the DAG and of the cluster also gets a vote, and the witness server does not. Instead, the witness server has this log file on it. It's called witness.log. It's sitting in a share that Exchange will set up for you. You can specify what you want the share to be, but Exchange can also set it up for you ahead of time. But basically, it's this one log file that we use inside this witness share to maintain quorum. And I'll show you how that works in a bit, but for now, these are the basic differences between the two cluster quorum models. One uses a witness, the other does not. So let's talk about the concept of witness then. So what is a witness? A witness, as I said, is simply nothing more than a share, a file share, a UNC path, if you will, that's located on some Windows server that's external to the DAG. Okay, that Windows server is not a member of the DAG now, it's never going to be a member of the DAG in the future. And its sole purpose in life, as I said, is to act as kind of a tiebreaker. The witness itself doesn't vote, but it allows one of the members of the DAG to get what we call a weighted vote. In other words, its vote will count for 2 instead of 1. The witness only comes into play when a decision regarding quorum is made. Now, what confuses people about the witness itself is really just a property of the DAG object. And really, that's all the DAG is. The DAG is an empty container object that by itself doesn't do anything until you put mailbox servers in it and then start to replicate databases across it. So the DAG is really just this empty object, and it's got properties associated with it, and one of the required properties is a witness property. Even if your DAG will end up having 7 members, you're going to go through the series of having 1 member, then 2, then 3, then 4. And as I said, as you add and remove members, you're changing the quorum model, and you will, on your way up to 7, use a witness for some of those deployments. So the witness has to be configured for every single DAG. If it's not configured, the DAG creation will fail. Okay, so keep that in mind. But even though it's configured for all DAGs, it's used only by DAGs that have an even number of members. So as you add the 2nd, the 4th, the 6th, and so forth, all the way up to 16th, that's when the witness will come into play, and that's when the cluster will start to monitor and so forth. The witness server doesn't have any quorum data on it, no quorum database, doesn't vote, and it's not a member of the cluster. Okay? It can be a member of a DAG, but not the DAG for which it's a witness. Now, the witness is one of the very few resources that are left to be managed by the cluster itself. There's no clustered mailbox server, so there's no Exchange resources to manage, but every cluster has a default cluster group, and in that group are the IP addresses associated with the cluster, in this case, also the same IP addresses assigned to the DAG, and there will also be a network name, and in this case, the property will be the same name that you gave to the DAG. Then, as you add an even-numbered member and we create this witness, there will be one more resource called the file share witness resource. And that is what represents this share, the monitoring of this share, on your witness server. Okay, now, because that's a cluster group resource, it's actually the cluster itself that's going to be managing it. It uses the same cluster is alive APIs to check the availability, ping the server? Can I get to the share and so forth? There's also one other file I didn't mention, and it's called verify-write-access.txt. It's just a file that the cluster uses just to sort of ping the share and make sure it still has access to it. But that file itself is generally unimportant to us because it's not used at all for quorum like the witness.log file is. Now, what happens if the share goes away or the server hosting it goes away or something causes this isAlive check to fail and the witness goes down? Well, in that case, by design, the cluster is going to try to restart it on another DAG member. And if it can do that, if it can bring them back online on another DAG member, that's great, life is good. If not, that resource will remain in a failed state and then the cluster will try to restart it once an hour. So if you have history working with clusters, this is brand new behavior in Windows 2008 that we didn't have before. So this might be new behavior for you. So once an hour, the cluster will try to bring it up. It won't keep moving it, but it will try to restart it. Again, if it can restart, it comes online. If it can't restart, it remains in a failed state. So how does that affect the witness? Well, the witness comes into play when you lose a sufficient number of votes that the witness is now actually needed to maintain quorum. So what that means, for example, is in my six-node DAG, now I've lost three votes, lost half the DAG. I need to make sure that the three survivors can communicate with each other and that one of them can communicate with the witness in order to maintain quorum. So if the witness is in a failed state and can't be brought online when it's needed for quorum, well, then quorum will be lost. The witness can't come online. There's nothing the system can do at that point. Quorum is lost. All databases inside the DAG on all members will dismount, the information store will terminate, and you'll have to manually intervene to either force quorum or recover enough of the failed members to regain a sufficient number of votes to get quorum back. That's the bad case scenario. In the good case, the normal expected state of the witness is going to be online. And so if the witness is online and it's needed for quorum, that's great. One of the nodes, typically we call it the locking node, and more often than not, it's the node that owns the default cluster group at that time, will reach out to that witness.log file and place a server message block lock on it, an SMB lock on it. Then, to keep track of quorum matters, particularly when a witness is invoked, there's actually some information inside that witness.log file. It's called Paxos tag information. Paxos is just an algorithm used by systems to keep track of state information when they work together. That's sort of uninteresting from an exchange perspective. But just so you know, what happens is the locking node increments its Paxos tag information, and that tells all the other nodes that he has a lock on that, and I need to try to communicate with that server in order to see if we have quorum. So once it's locked, whichever node locks it, this locking node, it retains a weighted vote. Its vote now counts for two instead of one. Okay, and that's how we get that extra tiebreaker. The witness itself can't vote directly, but once it's locked by one of the other members, that other member now has two votes instead of one. And then when the lock is no longer needed, once enough members come back up, as soon as that happens, that lock is no longer needed and it's released immediately. And that's actually done intentionally in case there's some other failure that's about to happen and some other node now needs to place a lock on it again. So what does that look like? Again, going back to our six-member DAG, it has a witness here. It's got this witness.log file in the share on this witness server, and we start losing servers. We lose one server, not a big deal. We still have more than enough members to maintain quorum. We lose another server, again, not a big deal. We still have enough members to maintain quorum. The solution comes up. But we lose one more server. Now the cluster needs to verify it has enough voters to maintain quorum. So what happens here is you saw the animation. This lock gets placed on by this node, the locking node. That locking node now gets a second vote. And when they look at the number of votes they have, they see they still have four, and they have enough votes to maintain quorum, and the solution will still stay up. Okay, so pretty simple stuff. But again, the key to keep in mind is that lock doesn't come into place. The witness doesn't come into play until that last server goes down, and we need to see if we need the witness for quorum. Then what happens after that, as soon as one other member comes up and now we have enough votes where we don't need the witness, that lock is released. And that extra vote that this one had is now no longer needed because we have enough regular voting members to maintain quorum. Okay. So the witness server itself. Typically, there's no pre-configuration necessary, especially if you're using a server that's already running Exchange 2010. In fact, by design, when you are creating your DAG, the system itself has the ability to look in the same AD site for a hub transport server that does not have the mailbox role on it, and if it finds that, it will use that server automatically as the witness server for your DAG. If you want, you can specify the witness server to use and manually specify the directory you want it to use, but more often than not, it's easier just to let the system pick it. Now, as I said, the witness server that you choose cannot be a member of the DAG. Okay, can't be a member of the DAG. Obviously, at the time you add it, we'll detect that and block that. And then later on, if you try to add that server to the DAG, we'll also detect that it's the witness server for the DAG, and we'll block that too. So the witness server can be a member of a DAG, just not the DAG for which it's a witness. Okay, so if you have multiple DAGs, maybe one of those members is a witness server for the other DAG and so forth. They do have to be in the same Active Directory forest, but unlike DAG members, which require the same domain, you can have the witness server be in any domain in that forest. It can also be any Windows Server 2003 server or later. The witness server itself does need a Windows server, but Windows 2003 or later with file or print sharing enabled works just fine. The witness server, because it only comes into play during times of quorum decisions, it doesn't need to be made redundant. It's not a single point of failure. So the witness server itself doesn't need to be clustered, for example, although if you do cluster it, there is a requirement that you use Windows 2008 clustering for that because of the underlying APIs that are used. But otherwise, it doesn't need to be clustered or made highly available. It's also not supported to replicate the witness directory using DFS as well. That's something that Cluster doesn't support, and so Exchange does not support that either. Single witness server can be used for multiple DAGs. They all do need their own directory and share, though, but because of the lightweight nature of the use of the share in the witness.log file, a single server can pretty much accommodate all of the DAGs that you have in your environment, unless, of course, that server is a DAG member itself, in which case that DAG will need a different witness server. Now, one thing I'll point in mind is if you do decide to go ahead and use a witness server that is not running Exchange 2010, maybe you don't have any other Exchange servers, and that's okay, but there is a code bug in there. We are mistakenly checking for permissions that you don't need to have, and when those permissions are not found, because they're not expected to be found on that server, we actually also, on top of that, give you a bad error message, too. So even if you follow the documentation and configure your witness server just fine, and you've taken the Exchange Trusted Subsystem, Universal Security Group, and you've made it a member of the local administrators group on your intended witness server because it's not running 2010, even if you do all that correctly, we will still complain that you didn't do that correctly and tell you that the witness server that ETS is not a member of the local admins group. The reality is we're not even doing that permission check. The check that we're checking is to see if the witness server itself is a member of the ETS group, which it should never be if it's not an Exchange 2010 server. Okay, so keep that in mind. If it looks like adding your non-Exchange 2010 server to the ETS group is fixing it for you, yes, it fixes that problem, but no, you don't want to do that. Those permissions are not needed, and it makes that witness server, it gives it the ability to manage all Exchange 2010 objects, which you don't want. So it's okay to have it be a non-Exchange 2010 server, and it's okay to just silently ignore this message if everything is working fine. So the blog entry I wrote has more information in it, and we're trying very hard to get that fixed for Service Pack 2. Now, there's also this concept of an alternate witness server. Okay, and a lot of people mistakenly believe that the alternate witness server is some sort of redundant witness server. It is not. The alternate witness server is simply the witness server that's used after a data center switchover. Okay, you can configure an alternate witness server for all DAGs ahead of time. If you want to use setDAG to do that, you can pre-configure it. Or if you don't do that, or if you pre-configured it but now you need a different server, you simply configure it using restoreDAG, which is one of the site resilience tasks you use to do the data center switchover. So it's at that point in the middle of your data center switchover that your DAG would be reconfigured to use a different witness server, reconfigured manually by you, the administrator, not by the system. There is no redundancy for the witness server built in, and DAGs do not dynamically change witness servers. Okay, let's talk a little bit about Active Manager. Active Manager is super important. It's the brain, if you will, of the high availability platform. Remember, we don't have a clustered mailbox server anymore. The cluster has no idea that Exchange is even there. And so what that means is if a disk fails, a database experiences a failure, or something else happens, the cluster cannot take corrective action for us. It's up to Exchange to do that. And because we don't use the cluster resource model anymore, we now have this new component called Active Manager that we wrote and rebuilt and that runs inside the replication service, and that is what handles all of the corrective action. Okay, it's also what does the monitoring. It's also what selects the best copy when a failure occurs and so forth. It's responsible for many, many things. It's also now the definitive source of where databases are active and mounted. Okay, historically, we would get that information from Active Directory, okay, but that was when databases were coupled to specific mailbox servers. That's not the case anymore. Databases are global org-level objects now, and as a result, they're not tied to any particular server. In fact, the designation of where an active database is located is active and mounted can really change within 30 seconds or less. It's that fast. So as a result of that, rather than Active Manager keeping track of where a database is inside of Active Directory, which would have really bad implications for us because of AD replication latency, we instead have Active Manager write all of the information about the entire solution into the cluster database. One of the benefits of doing that is anytime you write something to the cluster database, all of that information is instantly replicated to all of the other cluster members, all of the other DAG members in this case. So that's how we get that information communicated around. But that what that means for ISVs, for example, if you're used to slurping that information out of Active Directory, you can't get it there anymore. It's not up to date inside of AD anymore. You might be able to determine the mailbox, for instance, or the database on which the mailbox was created, and maybe a server on which the mailbox once existed, but you won't be able to track that around unless you change to use Active Manager client APIs instead. Now, there's three Active Manager roles. Only two are really interesting from an HA perspective, but Active Manager runs on every single mailbox server. The Microsoft Exchange Replication Service is a required component running at all times on every mailbox server. Okay? It's in the documentation. It's a required service that has to be running. Because Active Manager is not only the brain of all of this, it's also the gatekeeper for database mounts. Yes, the information store still does the actual mount, but now it will only do so if Active Manager asks it to do so. So if that service isn't running, Active Manager is not running, and the system won't mount databases. Now, the standalone Active Manager role, that's on a server that's not a member of a DAG. We're not really going to talk too much about that. But the other two roles, the primary Active Manager and the standby Active Manager, or what we call PAM and SAM, those are on every DAG member. We'll talk about how those roles are split out. Okay, but those are the two primary roles that we have. There's also this Active Manager client that we have, and that runs inside the RPC client access service on the client access server and inside the transport stack inside of Hub. CAS and Hub need to know where a user's mailbox is, one, so it can connect them up to that mailbox and get their data, whether it's Outlook or OA or ActiveSync, and two, so that Hub can deliver messages to that user when they come in through transport. There's a client running on both of those, and they get information from Active Manager in the DAG as to where that user's mailbox is located so that they can do their operations. So the primary Active Manager, that will always and only run on whatever DAG member owns the default cluster group. There's only one cluster group, and at any given time, only one member owns that. Okay, and that can move around from server to server, and as it does, the PAM role moves it. Now, the PAM role is also the only role that can take corrective actions. The SAM roles, as you see, can do some monitoring, but they have to ask the PAM to take the corrective action. It's only the PAM that can act within a DAG. It's only the PAM, for instance, that invokes best copy selection in response to a failure to choose the next database to activate. It also does things like react to server failures, and it also is responsible for updating the cluster database, and it's responsible for providing the interface, the RPC interface, for all administrative tasks. Anytime you're at your management station, whether you're using the shell or the console, you're invoking RPCs that are going to go to the PAM, wherever it is, and it's the PAM who will carry out those operations for you. The SAM will run on every other node of the DAG. So every other node that doesn't own the default cluster group is not the PAM, it's the SAM. And the SAM can do things like monitor the local information store for failure. So if the store crashes, SAM can monitor for that and tell PAM to take corrective action. It can also monitor for local storage failures. So if the disk underneath the database goes away, SAM can detect that and alert PAM to take corrective action. But the SAM itself can't do anything on its own. There is actually one exception. I'll talk about that in the deep dive. But really, when you think about it, the SAM itself cannot do anything on its own. It has to invoke the PAM to do that. Both roles, though, are necessary for automatic recovery. If you don't have the replication service running, Active Manager's not there. And if Active Manager's not there, databases aren't mounted, continuous replication is not running, failovers don't happen, and your solution is basically down at that point. Okay, let's talk about the auto database mount dial. How many of you have heard of this setting, auto database mount dial? Okay. So, let me ask you all a question. When a replicated mailbox database is affected by a failure, what are the two types of corrective action you can have the system do for you? Just shout it out if you know it. What are the two types? I'll give you a hint, we talked about it earlier. There's only two types you get from the platform. Automatic and bingo, exactly. Automatic and manual. Those are the only two types that you get. Oh, did he whisper it and you took credit for it?
No.
I don't have prizes, so it's okay. Why is auto database mount dial important? Because the automatic recovery is completely predicated on what this dial setting is and how many logs are missing on the copy that it's trying to activate. Okay, so you want to know about this dial. You want to be informed about this dial setting. The use of this dial, in fact, completely changes the way that Exchange operates with respect to databases and required log files. Now, this dial's not new in 2010. We introduced it in 2007. We changed the values. We had the same terms, and you'll see the new values in a minute. So we used the same terms, but we did change the values. They are different in 2010. But the whole point, though, is that it's this dial that controls whether or not a copy, a passive copy that's trying to be activated, will be mountable by the system. And depending on your dial setting and the number of missing log files, the copy may or may not be mountable. Okay, and the perhaps second best or third best copy might have to be tried to be activated instead. So there is a default setting, and I'll show you what that is in a minute, but basically auto database mount dial is set using the set mailbox server level. It's a server level control, so all database copies on that server are affected by the one dial setting. So how does it work? So I will point out the dial does not actually look like that, so when you install Exchange, don't go looking for some dial on your server. But it's a good metaphor because that's what we're talking about here. It's a dial setting. Historically, when you think about an Exchange database in 2003 and earlier, if you were missing log files at the end of the log string, that database would not mount. You had to do a hard repair to the database in order to get it to a mount, and that hard repair meant throwing away the log files that were needed and basically encountering data loss. We took that same idea one step further in 2007 and carried it forward into 2010 with this concept of auto database mount dial. The dial setting is basically the administrator's way of saying, I am willing to lose this many log files, but still have this database be mountable. Okay? And the dial settings, as you can see from the names, are based on availability. Good availability, for example, is the default. Okay, and when we say availability and good availability, we're talking about the availability of the data and service itself. So that means we think that to have good availability, to have the service reasonably up with a minimum amount of data loss, that a default setting of 6 logs lost would be appropriate. So that's what we chose, and that's why it's the default setting. And that's what it is in your environment right now if you have not changed that. All your servers are set to good availability, which was 3 logs lost in 2007, 6 logs lost in 2010. There's other settings. You can also use set mailbox server to set it to best availability. Best availability is better than good availability, but again, we're talking about the availability of the service and data, not the amount of data loss. In other words, you're willing in this case to trade off a little more data loss for the ability to have the service come up more quickly. The idea is you'd rather lose a few more megabytes of data than have the entire database come down and have to restore or recover. You're willing to tolerate a little bit of that data loss, in part because you also know of this feature called Transport Dumpster that's on every hub transport in your organization when you have a DAG, and that has copies of the messages in those log files. So when you are losing that log data, the messages representing that log data are recoverable through the Transport Dumpster mechanism. And you'll see that more if you come to Friday's deep dive as I walk you through every step in the best copy selection process. Now, this can also be overridden by an administrator, which is why there's also this best effort setting here as well. Okay, best effort is there, but it's a dangerous setting. Let's say you're outside the dial range. Let's say the dial range is set to 6 logs lost, and you want to activate with 10 or 12 or 15 logs lost. Then you're going to be overriding that dial setting. If you're under 12 logs lost, you can choose best availability because that's what best availability is set to. If you're more than 12 logs lost, then you've got to use best effort. But best effort is unbounded. Okay, best effort could mean I've got 100 logs lost, 1,000 logs lost, 10,000 logs lost. Best effort doesn't care. Best effort just says, I'm going to replay every single log you have, and when I'm done, I'm going to mount the database, and however many logs we're missing is how much data you're going to be losing. Okay, that's how it boils down. Now, there is a couple other settings. There's also a setting called lossless. If you can set all your servers to lossless, losses is the administrator's way of saying zero logs lost. If this passive copy that you're trying to activate is missing even one log file, do not mount it. Okay. Now, in a failover scenario, typically almost all failovers are going to be lossy failovers. There would be at least one log file that's missing. Generally, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but if you're set to lossless, that's going to prevent automatic activation. You'd have to have some sort of mechanism by which you can go get that one missing log file, get it over to the passive, and then have it be mounted up. Okay. Lossless also will change the way best copy selection works as well, but again, I'll talk about that in the deep dive session. Now, so we talked about the values. Best availability is 12. Good availability, which is the default, is 6. Lossless is 0. Best effort, as I said, is boundless. But we also do support your ability to just go into ADSI Edit and manipulate the attribute itself, the attribute on the mailbox server. It's the MSEXCH data loss for auto database mount attribute. You can set that to any value that you want. So, for instance, if you wanted availability that was greater than 12 logs lost, you could set that to 18, 20, 40, and whatnot. In fact, we specifically introduced the ability to customize that because we wanted to do that inside of our BPOS environment. And so there, we were running with a custom value. And so now, all administrators have the ability to use a custom value as well. Just keep in mind, when you go beyond 12 logs lost, though, because that's an increase in the amount of data that would be lost, you're also going to want to increase the size of your transport dumpster as well to account for that and to hold more data. So as more logs are lost, the data representing those logs can be recovered by the transport dumpster because now it's big enough to handle that. Now, the dial setting is consulted as part of the best copy selection process, or what we call BCS. Okay, so what happens is during a failure, a failover event, the passive copy being activated, in trying to become the active, one of the things we do is we try to reach out and copy over any missing log files. Maybe it's successful, maybe it's not, but once that process is done, once that attempt to copy the last log files is finished, it's at that point we see where we are with respect to the current copy queue length, how many log files are missing, and the auto database mount dial setting. If the number of missing log files is less than or equal to the dial setting, you get automatic deactivation of that database, and it will come up, and Transport Dumpster will recover any missing data. If the amount of missing log files is outside that dial range, though, then the next available passive copy in the list, if there is one, will be tried next. Okay? And that could be kind of a subjective thing. You'll see in the deep dive when we go through BCS that the first copy that it tries to activate might not be the one that activates based on the nature of the failure. It could be the next one or the next one. And it could be that the first one was outside the DAO range, but due to the nature of the failure, when it went to try to copy or activate the second one, it was able to get all missing log files, and you had a lossless failover as a result of that. Okay, let's talk about another concept called activation preference. How many of you have heard of this? Okay, not too many hands. This is new in Exchange 2010, and it's basically nothing more than a whole number that's assigned to every database copy. So, for instance, if I have an active copy and three passive copies, each one of those has an activation preference value that's either 1, 2, 3, or 4. Okay, and it's unique to each copy, so one has 1, one has 2, one has 3, and one has 4. It's pretty much that simple. Now, the way we use activation preference depends on whether or not you're running the RTM version or the SP1 version. So if you're running the RTM version, we just pretty much use it as a tiebreaker when we're sorting the list of potential passive copies by their copy queue lengths, by the number of missing log files that each passive copy has. If multiple passive copies have the same copy queue length, we break that tie using activation preference, where the lower the preference number, the higher the value in the list. Okay? In SP1, though, what we do is instead of sorting by copy queue length when you have the dial setting to lossless, we will go ahead and then sort by activation preference. So in other words, in SP1, when an administrator has explicitly set all of the servers containing a copy of the database to a lossless setting for the auto database mount dial, at that point, instead of sorting by copy queue length, we will sort only by activation preference. Again, with the lower the preference value, taking higher precedence in the list. So here's a very simple example. This is just a four-member DAG extended across two data centers. It's got one active copy, three passive copies of the database, and just arbitrarily, the activation preference numbers just happen to be 1, 2, 3, and 4. And unless you change them, they're going to be doled out in the order in which you created the databases. So assuming I created this one first, it's always going to have activation preference of 1. If I created this one second, it will automatically get an activation preference of 2, although at that point I have the option to change this to 1, which would change this to 2. If I didn't do that, when I create the next one, it gets 3, and then the next one I create gets 4. And then at any given time, I can change the preference numbers to whatever I want them to be. In this case, I like the way it's laid out because in a perfect world, I'd like the one that's in the same data center to be activated first before we activate one that's in a remote data center. Okay? But again, it's not always a guarantee. Activation preference is not a guarantee. And in fact, largely it's going to be based on the nature of the failure, the state of each of the passive copies and so forth, whether or not the attempt to copy any missing log files succeeds or not, and depending on what your auto database mount dial setting are as well. So there's a lot of variables that can come into play that could end up activating a database that might not be what you were thinking at the time was the best copy to activate. Now, you can reconfigure this on the fly. It's set by mailbox database copy, and there's also a GUI interface where you can just change the number up and down. And again, when you change the number of 1, it's always going to change the one that already has that number. It's a required property, so every database copy will have this number. And so if you change 1, you'll be affecting multiple copies, whichever one has the number you're changing to. It can also be used in SP1. We included this script called Redistribute Active Databases. And we also now have the ability for you to rebalance your DAG based on activation preference. Okay, you can also do it within a site or across sites, but basically it's your way of saying you've got a fairly equal DAG. A balanced DAG would be one in which the sum total of activation preference of all the copies on that server were equal to the sum total of all the activation preference for the copies on each other server as well. Okay, let's talk a little bit about circular logging and continuous replication. Now, how many of you have heard of circular logging? It's a very, very old concept in Exchange. It's been around forever. And in fact, circular logging, the JET-based circular logging, is something that up until Exchange 2000, for example, was turned on by default and just always did its thing. Circular logging was an invention that came about when we were limited by disk capacity. We wanted to make sure that we could write log files but not have the disk fill up. Okay, so we had a mechanism by which we were conserving disk space by simply overwriting a log file once the contents of that log file were committed to the database. Now, of course, circular logging historically could complicate recovery because if you do need to recover a database, it's in large part the log stream that you're using to do that. And obviously, with circular logging, there is no log stream. Okay? So there's two forms of circular logging that we have inside of Exchange 2010. One is called ESC, or JET circular logging. It's the circular logging that was born in Exchange 4.0 and carried forward into Exchange 2010. It's circular logging that the information store performs based on log activity. But there's also a second form that we introduced in 2007 when we introduced continuous replication. And that, as its name implies, continuous replication circular logging, is a different form of circular logging that you get when you're in a replicated environment. Okay, and we'll talk about the differences between them. Now, 2007 also included this. 2007 had circular logging, and it also had continuous replication circular logging. The store was responsible, and still is to this day, for doing circular logging in a non-replicated environment. But as soon as you replicate a database and you enable circular logging, now you've got a new form of circular logging called CRCL, continuous replication circular logging. Operates very, very differently from JET. Okay? So circular logging is basically about truncating log files or getting rid of log files after they're no longer needed. But we need that log stream in a continuous replication environment. I mean, think about it. What is continuous replication? It's log shipping. Okay? Without the logs, we have nothing to ship. So obviously, JET circular logging isn't going to do us very good. So we had to have the second form, this continuous replication circular logging. And its rules for overwriting, or in this case, truncating log files, are different from the JET rules. JET will just overwrite the one log file as soon as it's been committed to the database. In a circular continuous replication environment, however, we still need that log. We have to send it around to all of the copies, for instance. All the copies have to inspect it, for instance. All copies have to agree on the deletion. The file has to be committed to the active copy and so forth. So there's all these different rules that get enforced. So with circular logging, you don't really have log buildup, but in continuous replication circular logging, there will be log buildup. Because again, we're building up a small log stream so that we can replicate. And the amount of log buildup will be basically based on how quickly you can replicate and how quickly the other copies are able to inspect that data and agree with the active that it's okay to go ahead and do the truncation mechanism. Similarly, if you're taking backups in a database availability group, one of the things that a backup does at the end is truncate the log files. And the same truncation rules that we apply to circular logging and continuous replication circular logging, we also apply to the truncation requests that are happening as a result of taking a backup as well. And in fact, what ends up happening across multiple copies is typically the replication service on passive copies ends up communicating via RPC with the store process on the active copies, and they work together to coordinate the truncation of log files. And what's even more interesting is that the passive copy, say for instance you decide to back up the passive copy. We support that if you use Exchange Aware VSS. So what happens at the end of the backup gives the signal, go ahead and truncate log files. The passive copy does not truncate its log files at that time. Instead, it notifies the active by communicating with the store process via RPC, and it tells the active that a backup just took place, it succeeded successfully, it was a truncating backup, go ahead and truncate your log files. The store looks at its set of log files that needs to be truncated and does the truncation request. And the truncation request, like a lot of activity against a database, represents physical changes against that database that are logged through transaction logs. So what happens is the active does the truncate, puts a marker inside the log stream, which then gets replicated to the passive copies, and when they replay that log stream, they then do the truncation as a result of getting that marker and seeing those physical changes. So it's actually truncation on the passive is happening through the replicated log stream, whereas truncation on the active is happening by the passive reaching out, the replication service reaching out and telling the store that it's time to truncate. Now, We do have different components manage it. Again, the replication service is managing CRCL, and that's there so that we ensure the log stream is intact from a replication standpoint. The store manages JET, so in a non-replicated environment, when you turn that on, it's the store doing those functions. But what's confusing to some people is we don't have different names. We only call it circular logging inside the UI, inside the console, and inside the shell. So you turn them on and turn them off the same exact way, but the difference is the feature you get depends on whether or not you're in a replicated environment. If you're in a replicated environment, you get CRCL. If you're not in a replicated environment, you get JET circular logging. It's that simple. We'll look at whatever database is. One thing to keep in mind is CRCL can take effect dynamically. I can turn it on and off, and it doesn't have to do anything to the database, doesn't have to touch the store or anything. JET circular logging is not dynamic. It only takes effect on store startup, or excuse me, on database mount up. So what that means is in a non-replicated environment, if you enable circular logging, you have to dismount and then remount the database for that change to take effect. You don't have to do that in a continuous replication environment. However, there's no way to transition between the two, okay? Which means if you have it enabled and you are adding your second copy, your first passive copy, if you will, you're adding a second copy of a database, or you're removing the last passive copy of a database, so you're left with one active, both of those states would be effectively going from replicated to non-replicated or non-replicated to replicated. And as a result, if circular logging is enabled, we block you from doing that. We block you from removing that last passive or adding your second passive. Okay? There's simply no way to transition in that state. One thing that's confusing, though, is if you try to do that, you get a string back that says you cannot have circular logging enabled when you're adding or removing database copies. That string is incorrect. It's only when you're adding the first copy or removing the last copy of a database that it can't be enabled. And that's also something else that I'm working to get fixed in SP2 as well. But keep that in mind. You may get a message here saying that you can't have it enabled at all when you're adding or removing any copy. But again, it's only the first passive or the last passive that we block that. In fact, that's what the error message will be. Okay, let's talk about replay lag and truncation lag. So replay lag, that simply takes a replay. It's a property of a database copy, and it basically means you've got a replay lag time greater than zero, and that's an additional lag time that that passive copy will wait before replaying copies of the log files into its copy of a database. We call that a lagged copy. That is not a highly available copy. It is a lagged copy. Think of it as a point-in-time backup of a copy of up to 14 days. Okay, it's set with set mailbox database copy. You can do that at any time. You don't have to set it at the moment you create the copy, like you did, for instance, with standby continuous replication. In 2010, you can go ahead and set that at any time, and it will dynamically take effect without having to do anything special to the database. But lag copies are really just there for point-in-time protection. They're not necessarily a replacement for a full backup. They're there to really handle the somewhat rare case of logical corruption, getting into an active copy and then making its way into a passive copy. Physical corruption will never get to a passive copy. We can check for that and we can block that, but logical corruption we can't really check for, so that could make its way into a passive copy, and a lag copy being up to 14-day point-in-time copy can be one mechanism through which you could go back in time and have a non-corrupt database. When should you deploy a lag copy? Only when you need to mitigate the risk. You want to look historically at your own organization's experience with logical corruption. If you have a lot of third-party apps that integrate with Exchange and you have a long history with logical corruption, you're probably going to want to use a lag copy and maybe even some backup mechanisms. If you don't use a lot of integrated applications or you don't have any history with logical corruption, then you may not need a lag copy at all. Okay, it's that simple. One thing to keep in mind, though, as I said, lag copies are not HA copies. They're not copies that you want the system to automatically activate. In fact, when you deploy a lag copy, you are explicitly also going to block that copy from activation. Okay, otherwise, if the system activates it, it's going to play all outstanding log files. And not only will that take some time, depending on the amount of lag in your log generation, but it's also going to destroy the lag nature of that copy. So you never let the system automatically activate it. And when it comes time for a manual activation, if you go to this document and read the steps, you're actually going to be making a copy of your lag copy and then activating that copy of it forward to the point that you want. That way you still have a lag copy to go back to. You preserve that and you haven't destroyed the lag nature of it. Now, one other thing to keep in mind is that we have a feature in Exchange called Single Page Restore. It's there primarily to support databases running in a RAIDless environment, in JBOD, just a bunch of disks. And it helps patch up a page if you encounter a negative 1018 or a negative 1019 by getting a fresh copy of that page from another copy of the database. But that feature does not support lag copies. We cannot page patch a lag copy. So that typically means that almost always lag copies will be stored on a RAID array and not on JBOD. It's only if you had multiple lag copies that you would actually look at doing a JBOD solution. The truncation lag time, that's simply there so if you lose log files on your active copy, you've got log files on a passive copy that you can get and copy over and patch up that active copy. The truncation lag time simply means that you're delaying the truncation of the log files on that passive copy up until X number of days. Okay? And then you've got an X number of day window to go get any log files that might be missing or damaged on an active copy, copy them over from the passive copy, and get yourself a healthy up-to-date active copy without having to reseed the entire database. And that could be a tremendous time savings if you only have to copy, you know, 10 or 20 megabytes of logs versus reseeding a 50, 100 gigabyte or a terabyte-sized database. You definitely want to have those extra logs available. This is also configured using set mailbox database copy, and you're basically setting truncation lag time to a value greater than zero. Typically, you want to give yourself a little bit of a buffer there, too, in both cases. And in fact, using either of these, because we're either delaying replay of log files, which is going to cause log buildup, or we're delaying truncation of log files, which is also going to cause log buildup, using either of these features are going to have an effect on your storage design. You're going to need more capacity in order to support a larger growth of your log stream. Okay, so that's important. And of course, you're only going to want to do your design with our mailbox server role requirements calculator. And if you do that and plug in the lag copies that you're going to have, that calculator will help you estimate how much more capacity you'll need based on your actual lag times and your log generation rate. Okay, the last thing I want to talk about is continuous replication modes, because there are two of them. We've got file mode, and then in service pack one, we introduce block mode. So file mode, as its name implies, is our traditional shipping of log files from the active copy to the passive. Block mode, that's new. Block mode is actual shipping of ESC log buffers from the store process on the active copy to a corresponding replication log buffer in the replication process on the passive copy. And actually, block mode was specifically designed for two reasons. One is to eliminate the log drive as a single point of failure. You know, in a JBOD environment, the log drive becomes a single point of failure because it's not protected with RAID. And so that causes some customers concern because if the log drive goes away, it could take out the database with it and you might be left having to reseed or do a recovery if you're not replicated. So block mode was designed to not only do that, but it's also designed to minimize data loss as well, because we no longer have to wait till we have 1 megabyte of data in a closed log file before we ship data over. We can just take blocks of ESC buffer as they're being written and ship them over asynchronously to each passive copy. Now, both modes operate independently on a database level, and it's on a per passive copy level. So if you have an active and three passives, you might have a couple of the passives that can keep up, and they'll go into block mode. And you might have a passive that's just too distant, or maybe you've got high WAN latency or something like that, and it can't keep up. It might stay in file mode. Okay? And it'll independently switch as the copy queue is able to keep up or not able to keep up. So here's what it looks like. So I've got two copies of the database. The green one is my active copy. The blue one is my passive copy. Continuous replication file mode is always the initial mode. We always come up in file mode. And basically, it's doing the same thing that you'd expect. Over here on the active copy, we're generating log files. Now, continuous replication is a little different in 2010. In 2007, the passive copy used to reach into a read-only share, a read-only hidden share, in fact, on the active copy, and it would pull its own copy of the log files over an SMB share. In 2010, we don't use SMB log shipping anymore. It's all pure TCP sockets. And in fact, there's just one socket connection, one raw TCP socket connection between the two servers for each database. So here over this one TCP socket connection, it's the passive copy that says, send me the latest log files. The last one I have is file 2. So the active copy, knowing that it's generated 3 and 4, says, oh, I've got later log files. I'm going to ship them over to you. You can inspect them and then later on replay them. So 4 goes over, 5 gets generated, 5 goes over, and eventually what happens is now you have a database copy that's up to date. Or I should say eventually what you hope happens is now you've got a database copy up to date. Now it's saying that I don't have any log files that I haven't shipped over to you. In other words, the copy queue length is 0 for this database copy. So what that happens now it automatically and dynamically switches into block mode. Just does so under the covers, it recognizes this, and now what we do, we spin up this log buffer in the replication service. And as we're writing the ESE log buffer blocks that would eventually comprise a log file over here, we're asynchronously shipping them over that same TCP channel to the passive copy. So as a block is written, it's also sent over. We don't wait for an acknowledgement. It's asynchronous, not synchronous. But a block gets written, and it's sent over. Now what happens is, because the buffer's full on both sides, and both sides have basically the same exact data, they independently build their own next generation. So the active builds its own file 6, the passive builds its own file 6, and they are a bit-for-bit duplicate of each other. It's the same exact data, same exact log file in both places, but the data got over there much more quickly because it went in block mode. So the next block gets written and so forth, and let's say tragedy happens. Oh dear, something happened catastrophically to our database, and we only got some of the data over. We didn't get the full buffer. What do we do now? Well, we actually recognize that. We call that a log fragment. And we take that and we convert it to a complete log. Filling up a log and closing it without having a megabyte of data in there is nothing new in Exchange 2010. We had a log roll feature in 2007, and we still have it in 2010 that does a similar thing. This is a little different, though. We take the data that we have, and we turn it into a log file that we try to use. Maybe we got lucky. Maybe the little bit of data that came over was the end record of that transaction, and as a result of getting that little bit, we actually were able to keep all that data and close the transaction, and we didn't lose any meaningful user data. Or it could be the case that maybe that buffer was somewhere in the middle of a transaction, and as a result, it's not really usable data because we need the entire transaction in order to commit it. We just don't know, but either way, the system does try to grab that data and make use of it if it can. Okay. How do you tell if a database is in block mode or file mode? There's only one way to tell. We don't expose block mode or file mode anywhere else but in this one little performance counter that is called, and I realize this is small, but it's MS Exchange Replication, and then the name of the database, / continuous replication - block mode active. A 1 for that counter means block mode's active. That database copy's in block mode. A 0 for that counter means block mode's not active, it's in file mode. And these counters will change as it goes in and out of block mode and file mode. And as you can see, these are different database instances, 1 through 9. And there's also a total instance, so I can see 6 out of my copies here are in block mode, which means 3 out of my 9 copies are not. They're in file mode. That is the only way to tell. This is the only place we have any exposure of this feature whatsoever. Otherwise, there's no visibility of it whatsoever. It's completely transparent to the administrator. Okay, so with that, there's some resources for you, the Exchange Team blog, our documentation on TechNet, my blog, and my Twitter tag as well. And it looks like we are a couple minutes over, but I will step off to the side and take questions for those of you who have it. So don't forget to fill out your evals, because you can win this very awesome touch mouse. And if you win one, all the speakers will be jealous, because we all want one. They're that awesome. And of course, don't forget to download your card reader and do the mobile stuff too. That can be good fun to play that game too. There's also Microsoft Virtual Academy that we have. You probably saw this in other slides as well. And that's it for me. So thank you all for coming. I hope you show up on Friday for the deep dive. And as I said, I'm happy to take questions off to the side here. Oh, actually, you know what? I take that back. Don't go anywhere yet. We still have time. We start at 11:30. It's only 12:35. We have 10 minutes. We can do public Q&A even better. So I know if you want to go ahead and go. But if you want to stay and have questions, go ahead and raise your hand. We can do some questions. Yes, sir. How are you detecting logical corruption in a database? That's an excellent question. We don't. We do have tools. For instance, we had this tool prior to Exchange 2010 called ISIntegg. It was that tool that would be able to go and search through a database and do integrity checks of that database. We did not include that tool with Exchange 2010 in Exchange 2010 RTM. In SP1, instead of bringing that tool back, we came up with two new commandlets. One is that is called the new mailbox repair request. The other is called the new public folder database repair requests. Both of those are the replacement for ISIntegg, and both of those can go in and look for some forms of logical corruption, and they can also fix them. And the beauty of it is, unlike ISIntegg, both of those can do it while the database is up and mounted and accessible by users. But there are some forms of logical corruption that even those tools can't check. A zero becoming a one, or a one becoming a zero. Perfectly valid data, passes all system integrity checks, and there's no way for the system to tell it, but when an end user sees it, they notice it right away. They see things like, this calendar item won't stick. I keep having to accept this calendar item, and it doesn't stay on my calendar. Or I mark this item as red, and it's showing up as unread again. Those kinds of things. So when you see something like that, if an end user calls the help desk and they report something like that, that's when you would run the tools. The tools are not meant to be run as regular maintenance. There is no regular data integrity checks that you need to do in Exchange. So running ESUtil or ISIntegg are not regular maintenance activities. They're only activities that you do if you suspect you've got a problem in the database. And so those would be the tools that you would use. But again, it's not going to detect every single type of logical corruption that's possible. And just so we're clear of the two types, physical corruption is corruption that's caused by the hardware, by the controller, by the disk, and so forth. Logical corruption would be corruption caused by an application, perhaps Exchange itself, although in the entire history of Exchange, we don't have a single documented incident of that. But Exchange is an app, and it could do it. Or typically a third-party app that goes in and does something maybe around an API or implements an API incorrectly, and as a result does something that corrupts the data, changes that 0 to a 1.